that moment of tranquility. Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this Friday before Easter weekend. Very nice to be with you on this second day of April. We welcome you to the program. We certainly hope that you can join us in another way, and that is by writing to us. If you have something to say, if you'd like to comment, or if you have a question for the group, all you have to do is write to us, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we'd love to hear what is on your mind. So let us go now to our group to introduce them. Alan Chartok is here. Good morning, Alan. How are you?
Fine. And having a nice Friday morning, or TGIF.
TGIF, indeed. Very, very nice. Let's see. Former EPA regional administrator, visiting professor at Bennington College, president of Beyond Plastic, Judith Enck is with us. Good morning, Judith. How are you?
I'm good. That was really beautiful music.
It was. Absolutely beautiful music. And yeah, as I said, very tranquil. Kind of get you in the mood. It's good. Let's see. We also want to welcome Siena College economics professor Aaron Pasitti to the program. Good morning, Aaron. How are you?
Good morning. I'm doing well. Happy to be here.
We're happy that you're happy.
Good.
And David Soares is with us, speaking of ever happy, Albany County District Attorney and our dear friend. Good morning, David. How are you?
Good morning. How is everybody doing this morning? I have to agree with Judith. The music was great. And I know that Aaron, there's economic hope. We're going to be talking about the economy and jobs today. So I know you've got your headband, your wristband, and your yoga outfit ready to go.
Yeah, it's athleisure wear mixed with a little bit of the academic look.
So I'm sorry,
they're tweed yoga pants.
I'm sorry, is that a word? Athleisure? Is that a word?
Yeah.
Oh, I'm sorry, yeah. I missed it. Not at all, actually. All right.
Thank goodness we're not on Zoom.
Indeed. Quick shout out to Ray Graff for filling in yesterday. I got my second shot on Tuesday, and I felt great. I was here Wednesday morning. I felt great. And then I didn't.
Ooh. Oh, no.
And now I feel much, much better. So my thanks to Ray Graff for filling in at the last minute yesterday. I was in the car and ready to come in, and then I thought, that's not a great idea. So thanks to him and to Alan for making that so easy yesterday. Let's see. Let's start, shall we? And there are so many different stories, and we can go in so many different directions. And as soon as my computer fully loads, we can do that. Alan, anything you'd like to tell us while I bring up my load?
No, but I can tell you, Joe, that it was very cold walking this morning. I didn't quite expect
24 degrees, I think.
Yeah, and it was cold, and I thought I might have to turn back. But as usual, hip hip hooray, I didn't do it.
We're very proud of you. That's good.
Thank you, Joe. I appreciate that.
No, that's good. That's good.
Mario used to say, not bad for an old man.
Well, I would never say that, but it's a stick-to-itiveness that's very good. All right. So let's talk about there's a lot of stories. Let's start with economic hope. Why not start there? Unemployment claims increased slightly last week but remain near pandemic lows. A manufacturing index rose sharply. If you are looking for signs of economic hope, there are some. So, Alan, unless you want to kick this off, I'll throw it to Aaron, and then we can respond however you
wish. Absolutely. Okay. Go to Aaron.
All right. Aaron Pasitti, go ahead.
So this is really the first substantial bit of positive economic news we've seen in a while. In March, the U.S. economy added 916,000 jobs, doubling the pace from last month. So we've had three straight months of sustained and increasing job growth, and the unemployment rate ticked down from 6.2 to 6.0%. So this is good news. It seems like the recovery and the gradual reopening of the economy because of the increased pace of vaccination and the very wise use of government policy is doing exactly what it's supposed to, and that is giving people some financial support and encouraging economic activity. So most of the gains, again, came in leisure and hospitality, which is the, you know, the person-to-person in-face service transactions, hotels, restaurants, and so on. But the good news that we haven't seen in a while was that every major sector of the U.S. economy added jobs in March. So this is all good news. And even more so, when the Census Bureau and the Bureau of Labor Statistics conduct the survey, they do it in the second week of the month. So this happened on the second week of March. But during the last 2 weeks of March, we saw that an increasing number of states have widened their vaccine eligibility criteria. So we're likely to see, you know, as long as things don't take a turn for the worse in an unexpected way, continued strength throughout the spring and early summer. So this is good news. The only downside is that this 916,000 number of jobs added is not sustainable. Most economists are forecasting 500,000 job gains between or over the next couple of years. So this puts us back to where we were pre-pandemic sometime in mid-2022, which is, you know, when you think about it, actually like a visible and tangible point in the future. It's not, years away, if not a decade. So this is all very good news, and it's largely the result of competent government policy. You have vaccination distribution. You have coordination with states in terms of opening up vaccine eligibility. That's going to give consumers and businesses more confidence in starting to venture out, starting to spend more money. And we're also seeing some of the stimulative effects from the American Rescue Plan in terms of the stimulus checks, the unemployment insurance, some of the debt forbearance. So it seems like things are finally converging and moving us in a very sustainable direction forward.
I want to go to the rest of the panel, of course, but my quick follow-up is perhaps an impossible question to answer. But given that there is an increase in cases and we've seen there are concerns of another surge as the vaccine becomes much more readily available, could that have an impact?
It absolutely could. That is the one big wild card. I've been saying this since last March, that the trajectory of the economy will follow the trajectory of the virus. So with virus outbreaks, you're going to get reduced economic activity. So the one wild card is if this increase in cases becomes sustained and starts growing, then these gains could very likely be reversed.
Alan.
Well, you know, it's fascinating. I've been thinking about it a lot. Aaron makes a number of points that I think are worthy of discussion on the part of the panel and on the part of all the people who are listening, which is, what do you do? I mean, right now, when the COVID makes a reappearance, schools shut down unexpectedly and the rest, I just don't know. I know that I have family members who want to get together and do all of this. And if you do that, you're going to spend money. And that has to do with where we're going. So I don't know. I'm fascinated to hear what everybody else thinks.
Judith?
Well, I think the economists and the business leaders need to listen to the doctors. And the doctors are starting to really sound the alarm in terms of increased COVID rates, even in the face of vaccination. Thankfully, for the most senior elders among us, the COVID infection rate is down because many people have gotten vaccinated. But there are large segments of our population that are still not vaccinated, and there is a relaxing of restrictions. It's kind of counterintuitive. you know, I was recently invited to an indoor wedding in a couple of weeks. I'm going to pass on that one. large group of people. I love the bride and groom. I'll just send a gift. And this wedding is happening because the governor declared you can have indoor weddings with large numbers of people. You just can't like dance that close to each other. So that's not going to work. Sports stadiums are opening and you have doctors saying, slow the roll. I mean, we just have to hold on maybe even just another month with exactly. some restrictions. And, you know, Texas got rid of the mask mandate. They're in court because Austin wanted to keep the mask mandate. I just think we're on the verge of really blowing it. And that is not only going to lead to lots of human suffering and death, but also a real reversal on these economic bright spots. So hard to believe, you know, as a nation, we're still not getting it.
Have you had your vaccinations?
Yes, I had my second one just last Sunday, which I'm very grateful for.
So even though you could go to the wedding, right, you hesitate to do that. How come?
Well, the CDC is still telling you not to.
Right.
Interestingly.
Everybody has to make up their own mind. Yeah.
I may be safe, but I may be carrying it. So I'm going to be fine with outdoor events for a while. Eventually, I will realize my dream of entering a supermarket, but I'm not there quite yet. I will be, but you know, I just got my second vaccination a week ago, and thankfully, the only side effect was exhaustion. No other symptoms. So everyone, go get your second shot. Get your first shot. But it, you know, as Aaron has said for over a year, you screw up the COVID response, you screw up the economy, and we seem to be going in that direction.
You make an interesting point, though, Alan. You know, I think a lot of people who are vaccinated now are looking and saying, you know, what can I do? What can I do? What should I do? What shouldn't I do? And from the articles, there was a major article in the New York Times yesterday of, well, we still really don't know. You know, the science is still mm-hmm. questionable as to there are studies that say that you can't pass the virus. There's others that say that you can. There's, you know, there's people who have had the vaccine and unfortunately have also got the virus. It's interesting as we kind of figure all of this out.
Well, here's my rule. If you don't know, don't do it.
Yeah, right. Mm-hmm. Exactly. And also,
good rule.
Well, and it also comes down to comfort, you know, of what you're comfortable with, of what you personally are comfortable with. And
that's right. So, for example, I go to the supermarket, but Judith doesn't.
I go to the supermarket, but I hate it. Meaning,
well, I gotta,
there's still far too much uncertainty out there. There's far too much uncertainty out there for us to take the foot off the pedal now. I think mm-hmm. we've known from the very beginning that the way that we were going to make it through, you know, this pandemic was by obeying and listening to our scientists, no matter how inconvenient, you know, their news and their information was, we were going to have to listen to them. But as Americans being led by a fool, you know, that fool created these false choices, either a great economy or your health. You know, I know we're all inconvenienced by schools being closed down. He forced people to choose between open schools and healthy people. And so, you know, the injection of that poison that was put into the bloodstream of our country, you could argue is far worse than this pandemic, because at least for the pandemic, there seems to be vaccines that are out there, and there are new ones that are coming on to the market every single day, and people are now being vaccinated at record numbers, which are things that we should all be hopeful for. But what do we do about that venom that was put into the bloodstream right. of Americans, causing Americans to make that false choice? With so many Americans choosing not to get vaccinated. You know, what he has done to this country, and when I say he, I mean number 45, the president that was dumb out loud every day. What he has done to this country will have long-term implications beyond, you know, the hopefulness that we continue to experience now with this new administration and the advances that we've made in science, it's no surprise that we're going to see continued positive economic forecasts, because we always knew that we would get our economy back once we allowed science to lead the way. But as you've pointed out, and as Judith has pointed out, you got Texas. You've got states that are just opening up because it's politically convenient for them to do so. And their irresponsible actions are going to – it's going to be the anchor that is wrapped around the neck of America as we continue to do battle with this pandemic. And I have great concerns about that rhetoric continuing to be supported by Rupert Murdoch's enterprises. So, you know, Dr. Shartok, I'm one that's thankful for the fact that you have this program, and this is the kind of program where information can continue to be presented to people, factual information based upon science and data. But I don't think we're out of the woods yet. I think Americans continue to be confused by it's like having someone smile at you from across the room and mistaking it as a wedding proposal.
Yeah, or a gas pain. You know,
it should be an outdoor wedding.
As I was coming back from getting my vaccination was when the CDC director was breaking down and crying and talking about impending doom. It's hard to be too optimistic when you hear those words, impending doom.
Well, good for her. I mean, you know, she's being honest. And she knows what she's talking about. And I don't know if you've already talked about this week, but that interview with Dr. Deborah Birx on Sunday night. My goodness.
We're going to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation. We have much more to discuss. We have a wonderful panel to do it with. Alan Chartok, Judith Eng, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares. We welcome your comments. All you have to do is write to us. It's panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We ask that you keep your letters short and to the point. If you pre-read them before you send them, that's even better, because then we'll know that all the words that should be attached are attached. We'll continue our conversation. First, we're going to hear news from the BBC from London. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Friday morning. It is the 2nd of April, and it's 33 minutes past the hour of 9 o'clock. A couple of letters that we'll go to before we move on to other topics. Jay writes, good morning, panel. This is for Aaron. As much as I understand that there are times when deficit spending is necessary and appropriate, there are also times when we as a nation should pay down the credit card a little. Something we haven't done in over 100 years. Seems to me everybody needs to know eventually we need to work on the debt. Aaron Pasitti.
So before I answer that very important question, I want to say that I've been a panel member on the roundtable for 4 years, and I think each and every time I talk, I always rain on somebody's parade. And I think this is the first time where I've had something positive to say, and the rest of the panel rained on my parade. Thank you, David.
Well, yeah, I'm sorry.
I'm experienced.
You guys are absolutely right. Yeah. This is a fragile recovery, and it is not deep rooted enough that to withstand.
I don't want to speak on behalf of the entire panel, but I think I probably am when I say we're happy. You're happy.
Thank you. So the letter writer asked about deficits. The government is unique, and a lot of people confuse household finances with government finances. The government is not a household because they have the power to literally borrow unlimited sums of money. They have the power to tax. They have the power to print currency. They have an army. They have an infinite lifespan. So it's so that governments don't face the same debt payment structures that households face. You know, you have to pay your monthly credit card bill, and you can't take out a credit card loan to pay off another credit card. Governments have a much longer lifespan they have the ability to borrow trillions of dollars to invest in sectors where the payoff might not be for 50 plus years.
Right.
So because of that unlimited lifespan, the return, the government has the ability to assume massive amounts of debt and wait for the payoffs, you know, decades from now, unlike households and unlike businesses who have a much shorter time horizon. During times of recession, the governments should run high deficits to provide financial relief and stimulate the economy. There are other times, and I believe we're at a crossroads now, where governments have to step in, just like President Eisenhower did after World War II, and spend trillions of dollars on infrastructure development, whose payoff will be felt, you know, a half a century to a century from now. So paying down the debt now is probably the least wise move the government can make. Interest rates are low. The government debt burden is extremely low. Now's the time to be borrowing, not the time to be paying down the deficit.
I just want to know why we always seem to be talking about the deficit when there's a Democratic president and an administration. It's like this gentleman just wrote talking about the deficit and the credit card. Why is it that it's okay for Republicans to get the credit card, go ahead and spend it everywhere they want, and all of a sudden when a Democratic president and an administration gets into government, all of a sudden now we want to take the credit card away and give them the bill?
Besides hypocrisy, what would the answer to that be, Alan?
Well, I don't know. I think David is such a sagacious and wise man that he asks questions that can't always be answered. So I pass the ball.
All right. Let's move on to other questions because we do have them this morning. And again, we welcome yours. As a public school teacher, my school is essentially reopening at 70 to 80% capacity in just 2 weeks. 700 to 800 kids in hallways, on buses, and crammed into classrooms. The CDC says it's safe, but I just don't see how. Children don't usually get tested. It's impossible to know how much spread there is in the schools. It seems so silly. Schools reopening may help the economy, but at what cost? David, you were speaking about this earlier. Would you like to go further?
Well, that's
you know, getting through this, as I said before, you know, is going to require that we just make the necessary investments. It's not a false choice to choose between schools and having, you know, good health. I think that if we're tackling the issue correctly and we're obeying the science, I think you make the necessary investments. We can have both. It's just going to take us some time, but we all have to get on the same page.
Alan?
Yeah, it is. It's a classic tug and pull thing. You know, I've got children and grandchildren who want to be in school and who wear masks and who do what they need to do. But, you know, it is a very, very difficult choice to make. And I don't think there is a good answer other than to protect people's health. And, you know, unless you can guarantee that those kids are not going to be coming home with it or transmitting it, I don't see how you can advocate for it.
Judith?
Well, thank goodness we have confidence in the current CDC. I didn't in the prior CDC, and I believe that they were making recommendations based on public health protection in science. I mean, the concern is not just for the kids, but, you know, teachers and staff, and there's obviously a much higher incidence of the virus in adults than children. That has been been proven. You know, I think teachers have just done an extraordinary job with online instruction and parents who have been sitting next to their kids patiently. But a lot of kids are really falling behind and are suffering from some mental isolation. They do better with screens than others. And so I think the CDC is looking at the full picture. In the Northeast, at least, you know, April is here. You can open the windows in the schools. You can improve ventilation. Every parent has to make you know, the responsible choice for their kids. But remember, a lot of parents don't have Zoomable jobs, and a lot of parents don't have enough computers for multiple children in their homes. So especially for families that are economically struggling, you know, parents have to go work at a supermarket or a restaurant or a nursing home, and they need relief. So, you know, I think the CDC does err on the side of caution. And I certainly understand the concern from the letter writer. But again, the importance of not having another surge. France announced they're locking down for the next 3 weeks. You know, if we can reverse the current trend, the schools can be open. But once these numbers continue on the trajectory that they're currently on, I think this is going to be a moot point, and a lot of schools won't be able to reopen.
So what would you do, anybody, Judith, what would you do if, you know, you had an outbreak? The Southern Berkshire Regional School System has just announced a sort of temporary lockdown. Would you err on the side of, you know, what's good economically and socially for the kid and the parent? Or would you err on the point that, you know, you really don't want people who are getting themselves into huge health dangers?
Well, to me, it's easy. Yeah, the CDC has said that these are, you have to consider local infection rates. And so if there is an uptick, they are not recommending that schools go back to in-person instruction. So I think the example you just cited sounds like they're following the CDC policy. If you are in another community where infection rates are low and you have good ventilation, you take all of the precautions, CDC is saying it is responsible to reopen.
So what would low be?
You have to look at the local situation.
So what would low be? I mean, what happens if you get two people who are infected? Is that low? We know that the entire COVID thing started with one. So what do you do?
The CDC has a formula, you know, and local governments have a formula in terms of which numbers prompt what action. It's certainly imperfect because people cross county lines all the time, but these decisions have to be based on science and protecting public health. I mean, I think for the first time we can have first time as compared to last year, we can have confidence that these are health-based decisions.
Is science political?
No, science is not political, but the way that policymakers and elected officials interpret the science certainly is politicized.
Well, you said we have to follow you said we have to follow the science. I'm not trying to be provocative here, but if the science leaves room for interpretation one way or the other, I think the question is a good one. Can we depend on an imperfect science or imperfect, you know, judgment on the part of the people who are interpreting that science?
It's all about the interpretation. I mean, I think science is science. You know, a warming planet is a warming planet.
Right.
You look at COVID. Look at how the governor of Florida, DeSantis, has really mangled science versus other governors. So science is not the problem. It's politicians who are worried about short-term economic impacts and having that override the science in some situations.
Well, you know, it's not only
that has been our relationship with science, politically speaking, dating back, you know, decades on top of decades. You know, Ron DeSantis didn't come on board, or Donald Trump didn't come on board, and all of a sudden start to chip away at science. Science has been chipped away by the tobacco industry. As far back as the you know, the 60s, the 70s, whenever science was brought into the discussion about why we shouldn't all be smoking, science has been chipped away at by the fuel industry. And those industries have been successful for decades. So the fact that science is not respected, at least by one party, it shouldn't come as a surprise to anyone.
Okay. Let's pause there. We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We have more letters, and we have much more to discuss. We will do so with our panel, Alan Chartok, Judith Enk, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares. We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable. We're getting a lot of letters asking about this morning's music, and you can find it on our website. It's wamc.org/roundtable. We always have a playlist posted, wamc.org/roundtable. But we're playing Tom Caulfield this morning from his most recent album, Arrive and Disappear. All right, let's go back to the letter.
Wasn't he the coach of the New York Giants?
And in his spare time, pretty good on the guitar. Larry writes, President Biden is proposing spending several trillion on infrastructure. It's not just about building things. It's about addressing longstanding problems, like the way expressways cut up cities that made them work badly, like 787, mm-hmm. cutting off access to the Hudson, or the Empire Plaza destroying neighborhoods and hundreds of small businesses. How would you like to see the Capital Region built back better? That's a lot to say. We have underused rail corridors running in all directions. What if we invested in rail and bus transit the way we invested in highways? For example, $30 million for a new Northway exit to get to the airport 10 minutes faster and adding more parking. Anybody?
It's a
It's a very Albany-centric letter.
Was he criticizing that exit? And using it as, I don't understand. I was with the letter writer until the end.
Yes, I agree with you because we have that exit, right? So I don't know. I'm not sure.
But I think his general point is an excellent one. It's not just spending. It's not just like getting a whole bunch of people together and digging a hole in the ground. It's what are the programs that will be funded? So having more livable cities means having better mass transit. Electric buses, more frequent bus routes, light rail, people living in Clifton Park who need to get to Albany, no reason why they have to spend half their lives tied up in one person per car on the Northway. I mean, I think what the letter writer is suggesting is some advanced planning with sustainability at the core, and that has great potential to improve quality of life for many of us.
Let's go.
I love that letter writer because, this gives us an opportunity to reimagine our cities and reimagining them in a way that is not isolating, black and brown communities that are often, thrust upon the edge of communities and, they have no economic stimulus, but it's an opportunity to create a different vision for your city and to make that city much more inclusive. And it's about creating opportunities for people as well to have sustainable employment. And so this is an exciting, exciting time. And I just hope that we don't squander this opportunity to do this for the future of our country.
So mashing two thoughts and letters together, we go to Ken, who says it's been 100 years since we pay down the debt, How quickly we forget. At the end of the Clinton presidency, everyone from the chair of the Fed to George W. Bush were saying we were paying the debt down too quickly. Bush was elected, taxes were cut, the debt went up. Today, debt is cheap and our bridges are crumbling. Aaron.
Yeah, that's exactly right. The only time the U.S. government ran a budget surplus was at the tail end of the Clinton administration. And then when that proved to have some positive economic benefits, you heard Republicans jumping in saying, well, now a surplus is the dangerous thing. So David hit on this earlier. The deficit is a political tool. Deficits fundamentally do not matter for a government, provided they have the industrial base to back up their spending, which all advanced economies do. The only downside, when people talk about the deficit, I always ask them, like, well, why are you concerned about the deficit? That's fine if it's a philosophical principle and that's something people believe in, but that doesn't mean we shouldn't do it. So the only cost to the economy of a higher deficit is usually higher inflation. But we have the Federal Reserve that's designed to pretty much fight inflation. So in terms of just economic administration, the deficit does not matter. We have ways of controlling it, but it is hijacked. It has been hijacked as a political tool, particularly by Republicans. Democrats have been fairly unwavering in, no, deficit spending can be good for the economy. Here's how. They've just never had an opportunity to get those plans through. So this is kind of a once-in-a-generation opportunity where the, you know, economic and social and cultural conditions are, you know, frayed, and you have the political will to do it. This could be a crossroads in Democrats being able to implement some of these policies and in a couple years say, see, we told you this was going to be good for the economy. So I'm really crossing my fingers that the Biden administration does not squander this by listening to people who are concerned about the deficit. Being concerned about the deficit now is like complaining that the grass is too long when your house is on fire. That's the equivalent of it. It's a relatively minor point given the overall magnitude of what's been happening, not only over the past year, but the past, you know, four decades of rising inequality.
Alan, were you going to say something?
No, I'm fascinated by the quality of the discussion here. You know, all I know is that we're told that that we really are paying, you know, that there's no real graduated problem with how much everything costs. But think about it for a second. How much do you pay for a Coca-Cola now? Not you, Joe, because you don't drink Coca-Cola anymore. But how much does one pay?
It's like over $2.40.
Yeah, over $2. I remember when it was a nickel, two. What was that?
Joe, was that? I'm just glad he followed up by saying a cola, because I was like, it's deeply personal. You're going to ask the man how much he's now paying for Coke.
No, that's right. That's right, Mr. District Attorney. I don't want to be misinterpreted here because I like my freedom.
And by the way, if I knew the price, it would just be because I have to walk on Central Avenue from my car to the station. Alan, were you going to say something else?
No, you keep asking me if I was going to say something else, and I wasn't going to say something else.
No, I thought you were. I didn't know where you were through with your point.
And I have no intention of saying something else.
Okay. with that, we'll go to more letters. We have those, so we'll get to them. That's right. You were asking what that sound was, and that sound was was my phone.
Somebody's calling you.
As an almost 70-year-old who is a never-Trumper, or even close to that, I resent the comments that anyone who is on the fence about vaccine is being lumped together with Trump supporters and being influenced by the rhetoric. There are many reasons why people are on the fence. Folks with a history of allergies, African Americans and Native Americans with a history of the government experimenting on them, etc. There are other reasons for fear and skepticism. Please don't lump us together. All right. Thank you. Let's see. We go to... we go to
quick.
No, I'm sorry. Sarah's commenting on some of the letters, and I'm amused. Why can't the Democrats get messaging right? Instead of talking about raising taxes on corporations and the rich, why not say it's returning tax rates to where they were before Republicans gave them a big undeserved gift, which not only sounds better, but is the actual truth? Aaron?
Yeah, you know, the richest 1% of the population, so you're talking millionaires and billionaires, have been really the only beneficiary of tax cuts since 1980. The rest of the population, maybe a couple $100 in reduced tax payments. But I'm surprised that Biden isn't saying, let's return to Reagan-era tax rates, because that would almost double the tax rates paid by the richest 1%. So I'm all for Reagan-era tax rates. That might be a surprising thing to hear, but they are substantially higher than they are now.
All right. We go to Brian. The GOP is not against the deficit. They are against progressive spending something. Unfortunately, the word that this is goes into the pre-reading category, but okay. Andre says that Galileo could attest to the silencing and distorting of science as it related to the political forces of the day. Ed writes, David's summary of the great job WAMC does spreading sound, intelligent information for the public good just reminded me of why Friday is my favorite panel day. What great guests, intelligent and humorous interaction. Kudos above all to Alan for creating a panel concept so many years ago and building it ever since. A truly great way to start each day and a tangible benefit to the community. Well, thank you, Ed. Isn't that nice? We go to William, who says the CDC director did a disservice to the public. She isn't paid to be someone's mother, wife, or daughter. She's paid to disperse sober, accurate information on the virus and offer sound reasons why we should follow the suggested guidelines. She did neither. She let her emotions dictate her message, give the people the information that informs their decision, leave the emotional drama out of it.
I think she was terrific.
Just a touch of sexism in that
Absolutely.
Letter.
Yeah.
Please.
I think she was terrific.
Some people prefer to have their information transmitted to them through Siri, apparently.
Well, we go to John asks a question, and I didn't know this, so I've already screwed this up, but it's a good question, which is when it comes to your vaccination card, do you laminate it or not? I got mine laminated because there are stores that do it for free, and I thought it was cool because you had both shots. But the answer is you probably shouldn't get it laminated because if there are boosters, they will need to write those on the back.
But
of
you
the
should
card.
Take pictures of the card when
front
I ask
and
that
back.
Question.
Yes, yeah, front you know, and
on
back.
On your phone, put it on your phone, make a couple photocopies.
And
because you don't want to lose that little card.
No. And if you do, and if you, after 2 weeks, you have your Excelsior pass, if you are a New York State resident, then that will take care of that as well, which will have your testing as well as your vaccination records. So thank you, John, for that. Paul says, do people truly not understand the modern economic? Well, I'm going to hold this letter because it's a big one, and I'm sure Aaron's going to want to answer it completely, and we don't have time for that right now. We do have time for Ray Graff and news, so we will go to that. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org. We will return. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. We have Alan Chartok, Judith Henk, Aaron Pasitti, and David Soares with us. And, of course, we always have you with us, you know, when you turn on your radio or are listening, however you listen, streaming. Maybe you're listening to us 2 days from now on a podcast. We don't know, but we're glad that you're listening to us regardless. So let's see. We'll go to some letters here, and then we'll move on to other topics. We have several. Personally, this from... Connor writes, personally, if the combination of 500,000 plus deaths and responsibility for American health doesn't get you emotional, I don't know. I don't want to know you. So that was in regards to the comment made earlier about the CDC director. Let's see. We go to Kathy, this is a real question, and I'm completely lost as to how to deal with it. How do you respond to a friend when they tell you with heartfelt belief, I'm definitely not getting the vaccine? Bill Gates has added nanobots to the vaccine. I've heard this. This is a real thing. This is a born-again friend who indeed voted for Trump, but I'm still not ready to give up on them. What do you tell them? Does anyone have an answer to that question for Kathy, who is rather stymied by this? David?
Keep Zooming with them and don't invite them over for tea.
But you also want to maybe nudge them into getting the shot.
Yeah, no,
point,
I think
point
that's
them.
Right.
Try to educate them.
Yeah, right.
Because you love them. They're your friends and they're your family. But I understand how sensitive these conversations can be. And this person is not alone. There are millions and millions of people who believe this. And so when I originally stated earlier that the injection of doubt and that kind of venom in the bloodstream of America is almost much more dangerous than this and some than this virus, there's some truth to that.
Alan?
What he said is right. And I particularly like the part about, you know, you really can't afford to give up. So you just calmly speak the truth as you know it and hope that some of it will get through. And when they're dreaming at night, some of it will enter their brains. But I do know an awful lot of people who won't talk to those kinds of people at all. So I'm not talking to them.
Yeah.
I have a very good friend who won't go out with a guy because, you know, he believes that stuff. So, you know, it's you really have to just try to make your point and make it well and then just hope that some of it will get through. I don't see any other alternative.
Judith?
Well, it's extremely frustrating. We've all had these experiences. And what I find troubling is the people, for whatever personal reason they have, don't want to get vaccinated. And also don't wear masks in public. And it doesn't just affect them. It affects their families. It affects their coworkers. And I think all you can do is calmly keep engaging with the facts, but really hard to argue on that chip point. I mean, I just think it, as David has said, 4 years of Trump has really damaged the intellectual capability of this country. And it's a problem because it's going to affect herd immunity. It's going to affect reopening. You know, it's no person is an island. You know, if you've got these stronger variants, which we know are in our country,
right,
and large numbers of people not getting vaccinated, it affects all of us potentially.
So this was the question I was about to read going into the last break, which I paused on because I wanted to give it more time. This from Paul for Aaron. Do people truly not understand the modern economic theory? Or is it truly disregarded by so many people with the authority to make economic policy? It seems to me to make so much sense, but when I try to explain to other people, it seems like I'm talking Greek, or maybe I'm not good at talking to people. Aaron?
Good question, Paul. And I think you really hit the nail on the head. We've been talking about how politicians sometimes disregard science when it's politically convenient for them. I think you could also say that politicians disregard social science when it's inconvenient to them. I am not lumping economics into, epidemiology or anything. I think Republicans fully understand how economic theory and economic policy works. They know that tax cuts do not unleash growth. They know that government spending on infrastructure will boost growth. So, and I'm speculating here. I have to imagine they know. Most politicians are not dumb in that they understand the basics of how this works. So the ideological opposition to Republicans about government spending comes from the fact that they know it's effective. And if it's effective and the other party does it, that's bad news for them. So the reason that I think a lot of Republicans are opposed to, you know, spending and investment on infrastructure and education and programs like that is because they know it will be effective. And that's not the world they want to live in because those are not policies that benefit their donor class. So they harness the power, the magic of tax cuts and the magic of, private defense contracts with the government, because those are government policies that cost money but enrich the donor class and increase their chances of reelection. So I think everybody understands it. I just think that there's an ideological opposition to preventing it from becoming successful to maintain political power.
Is it possible, Aaron, that most people don't have the slightest idea what economics involves, period? They don't know squat?
Yeah, I mean, there's that too. Some things that you know, I take for granted that there's just like this baseline level of understanding about how the government's different from a household, and therefore they have a different deficit financing equation. I think a lot of people don't understand that, and that's unfortunate. I think economics should be taught along with personal finance at, you know, in high school, but that's another story. But I think politicians and policymakers do know exactly how economic theory works and what Biden's American Jobs Plan is likely to do, and that is generate long-term growth. But that is not in the interest of Republican politicians and the top 1% of the population.
Anybody else on that? All right. Let's go on to other letters. We go to, let's see, we go to, who is this person? This person is Russ. When I feel coronavirus fatigue, I remind myself that this is not a game. No timeouts, no halftimes, no between innings. No wonder we're all feeling fatigue. Certainly. On the issue of nanobots, you need to tell folks that are worried about injected nanobots that they are already carrying that chip in their pockets and it's called their cell phone. It's a very good point. On the vaccine, Harry says vaccine issues are very complicated. Example are people that received vaccine 6 months ago, i.e., or for example, healthcare workers still protected. Vaccine manufacturers, the FDA, CDC, have no data yet to help answer the so many questions that come up. Also a good point.
I saw something yesterday, Joe, that said, or this morning in one of the papers, that said that 6 months that the big guys, the Modernas and the Pfizers, and one of those two actually, were saying you're now protected up to 6 months and we know it.
Right. So then, and then this, I think this letter writer is saying, so if you are.
What happens after
months. So if you got your shot 6 months ago, which we're coming up on that now for for the frontline workers, you know, then what? You know, and so.
I'll tell you what's going to happen. After 12 months, and assuming that we're doing well, they'll say it's now been proven that after 12 months, you're okay. So, so that 6 months is here. And so 6 months becomes the line.
Mm.
Well, and I think it's important to remember that this is all so new. I mean, they were making predictions based on clinical trials, and now they're making it based on real life experiences. And so there's going to be a very long period of time that we don't have certainty, which is why the CDC recommendations are so important.
David, were you going to say something? I'm sorry.
Oh, that wasn't me.
Okay. All right. That's fine.
I'm still caught up on the fact that Coach Tom Coughlin plays the guitar as beautifully as what I've heard today.
Caulfield.
I'm still stuck on
Tom Caulfield. Yeah. Holden's Tom brother. Caulfield. Yes. Okay. Let's go over to Mike, I've heard a number of people criticize vaccinating prison and county jail inmates. I see that as an important issue because it not only protects the inmates that some may not care about, but it also protects the corrections officers as well, and we purport to care about them.
What do you think, David?
Well, it took a lawsuit by the Legal Aid Society to direct the Cuomo administration to offer vaccines to people in prison, and you know, there's the humanity of it, but there's also, let's say you're in prison for a year, that should not then become, you know, a de facto death penalty if you're in a congregate setting like that and you you come down with the virus. I mean, I think it's abhorrent that it took a lawsuit, I believe by Legal Aid, to get people in prison vaccinated. And that was just decided last week.
David?
Of course. I mean, that's, look, these are issues that quite honestly, we shouldn't even have to argue about, right? I mean, people go to jail, people come out of jail. You can't have, 100% community health if what's happening is you're deciding to, hey, let's have vaccinations for a portion of society, but then these other individuals who are going to eventually be released back into society, we're leaving them vulnerable. But it doesn't make any sense that this is something that should have been put in place and should have been put in place some time ago. And so the the fact that it required a lawsuit, it's shameful and embarrassing. But, you know, hopefully we can all be vaccinated in the not-too-distant future.
Let's go to this letter, then we'll move on to some other topics before our bottom of the hour break. Leonard writes, the Koch brothers, now only one, are committed to an Ayn Rand ideology that believes government should be crushed because it redistributes wealth and smothers entrepreneurial initiative. They are the true enemies of the people. That from Leonard. Aaron, do you have anything to say about Ayn Rand ideology?
Yeah, I think it's coming, you know, just like Marxism, that, you know, Randian libertarian philosophy is, you know, an interesting theoretical construct, but in terms of dealing with real world problems and, you know, people don't always behave rationally and people abuse government privileges for their own benefit. And that can distort market outcomes far worse than a simple government intervention can. So I think we're seeing that now. 40 years of Randian supply side trickle down economic philosophy is starting to lay itself bare in terms of the harm that it causes and a lot of the distortions in economic activity that it causes.
This from Carolyn, who says, thank you, Aaron, for your cogent, succinct, plain English and right on economics 101 explanations. Teach on, Aaron.
That's great.
Thank you.
She then goes on to say, no need for any vacancy or no need for any chip, your nanobot, I guess. Your chip is in the wallet and every debit and credit card you use. The companies track you within less than 10 seconds of every purchase of where you are and where you're going. So another
and your
good
easy pass in your car.
Right. We have a lot of nanobots in us or around us. Let's see. Let's move on,
you know,
to.
Yeah, and go ahead. To that point, Joe, can I just say one
of
thing?
Of course.
It always amazes me at how people have no issue with surrendering privacy rights or taking any issue when it comes to the private sector. But they have all of these conspiracies and want to stand tall when it comes to the government, you know, having any information about the bubble. Because you're right. We have surrendered so much of our liberties to the private sector, especially with respect to technology, that it's kind of hilarious to see people now being concerned about, you know, nanos and 5G technology in a vaccine.
We're going to become zombies every... okay. Let's see. I want to talk about this issue. Of course, the infrastructure bill or the infrastructure plan was announced. $2 trillion was announced by President Biden on Wednesday. So from the New York Times, in 2017, as Donald Trump was announcing the United States' withdrawal from the Paris Climate Accord, the largest global effort to attack planetary warming, he declared, "I was elected to represent the citizens of Pittsburgh, not Paris." On Wednesday, President Biden traveled to Pittsburgh to try to make the opposite case, that the workers Mr. Trump was appealing to have more to gain from combating climate change than to lose. It is going to be a tough bet, says the New York Times. To Mr. Biden, a $2 trillion infrastructure plan is about creating union jobs, hundreds of thousands of them, in wind and solar power, electric cars, and road and bridge building. Even those more basic infrastructure projects would have a climate angle. The new roads and bridges would be built to withstand the high waters and brutal storms of a changing climate. Mr. Biden said on Wednesday, "I am a union guy. I support unions. Unions built the middle class. It is about time you start to get a piece of the action." Alan, or
yeah. That's exactly right. I mean, that's what this election was all about: the haves versus a lot of the people who have been kept down. And he's saying, okay, unions, let's go. You know, unions have a lot to answer for, including some internal corruption that they didn't play well. But, you know, in the end, I taught at SUNY for a long time, and I had a living wage because of the union, no question.
So, Judith Enk, how big of a bet is it for the president of the United States to tackle climate change by saying it will create jobs, not kill them?
Well, he's absolutely right. It will. And the debate is going to be around whose jobs. And I'll get to that in a minute. But I think the $2 trillion infrastructure plan is long overdue. I actually think it should be substantially larger than $2 trillion if we're actually going to address climate change as opposed to kind of nibble around the edges. Big commitment to solar, to improving mass transit, which, by the way, should also include making communities safer and easier to bike around and having bicycle connections at mass transit hubs and things like that. And both Senator Schumer and President Biden are very bullish on electric cars. I think that's a really good thing, but I also want to point out that it's imperative that the electricity be clean, renewable electricity, because if you're charging your electric car from a fossil fuel power plant, that's certainly better than the status quo, because there are more pollution controls on a power plant as opposed to the tailpipe of a car. But it's really important that this be accompanied by making sure that the electricity generation is from clean renewables. So it's also going to take some coordination with state governments. The disconnect we saw this week, just yesterday or the day before, the New York State Public Service Commission held a public hearing on the Danscammer power plant in Newburgh, where the proposal is to run that on fracked gas. So you want your electric car running on a clean energy source, not necessarily fracked gas. So we've got to get the coordination between the state government and the federal government on these issues. So I started by saying it should be a bigger number, but I do want to acknowledge that it's going to be hard to even get $2 trillion through. There is the difficulty of Joe Manchin in West Virginia, who is still clinging to coal jobs. And there is a problem with some unions. Some are embracing clean energy. Others are still holding on to the dying fossil fuel industry. And in that New York Times article, they quoted a union leader by saying, you know, just transitioning from working at a power plant to a clean energy project, that's not how it works. This union guy said, we build power plants, petrochemical plants, and maintain steel mills. That is all true. And so part of this has to include a just transition. How do you make sure that workers not only have replacement jobs, not working in fossil fuel, but that those jobs pay well, have health insurance? And that's where I think Biden is really going to serve the country well. He is so credible with unions, and we need unions to stop supporting any polluting facility that comes along and really thinking about the long-term livelihood of their members. The future is clean energy. The future is not fossil fuel. Just look at, you know, look at the economic situation with fossil fuel investments. That's why, while overdue, it's good that New York State Comptroller DiNapoli divested from fossil fuels in the state pension program. Not only is that good for the environment, but that's really good for people relying on that income, because fossil fuel stocks, I'm sure Aaron would back me up on this, are just tanking because the future is not fossil fuels. So I think Biden is embracing all of that. I think it's going to be very hard to get this through the Congress. So the proposal is good, but now it has to be adopted.
David, anything on that?
I think the bottom line for unions, it's not so much the substantive science. It's what you just talked about. It's about health insurance. It's about providing for your family. If we can demonstrate that these alternative energies that we have available, that is in fact the future, if we can demonstrate that you can build an entire industry and offer, you know, union employees the same benefits, if not better, by engaging in this practice as opposed to the traditional practices of coal, then we're well on our way to achieving that goal. I don't think that it can continue to be abstract. I think that, you know, for example, West Virginia, you know, I think some of the first clean energy plants have to be built in places like West Virginia so that you can see the politics of West Virginia change. And maybe you can have a Democratic senator there that isn't, you know, I don't know, Democratic on Wednesday and perhaps a conservative Republican on Fridays. But that's how I think we begin to change the dynamics of Rust Belt politics, of even, you know, red state politics, is by putting the money where the mouth is and actually begin developing these industries and demonstrating to organized labor that it is, in fact, possible.
All right. We just have about a minute, Aaron.
Yeah. So the thing to recognize is that any type of major change is going to result in some sectoral job losses. That's inevitable. Historically, though, the U.S. economy, when we've made major changes like this, whether it's the shift from agriculture to industry or the shift from industry to services, you need to provide a safety net for the workers who are adversely affected, whether, you know, healthcare subsidies, education subsidies, retraining, anything that makes that transition easier it will be politically popular and economically advantageous.
I totally agree with that. And I just want to make one final point. It would be really disappointing if Joe Manchin's desire to protect literally a few hundred coal mining jobs in West Virginia stand in the way of solving planetary climate change. So I think Biden knows he needs to be proactive, do what David said, really focus on West Virginia like a laser. The sad reality for West Virginia is there are very few coal jobs left.
We'll be right back. Good morning. Welcome back to the Roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. We are going to this is our last segment, so we welcome you and your thoughts. Panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, and we welcome your letters. But we're running out of time, so if you want to include them, please do it quickly. All right, so this is the latest. We talked about the story a couple times this week. I think we talked about it on Wednesday, was the Matt Gaetz story. And so the latest on this is the Justice Department inquiry is said to be focused on cash paid to women. The congressman and a former official in Florida sent money to the women using cash apps. And this story broke last night of the New York Times actually reviewing the receipts that were used. Most of these, I think some were done in cash. Others were done through the aforementioned of what we've been talking about this morning, through our digital footprint. And there's a couple lines here that while we should note that these are allegations and Mr. Gaetz denied ever paying a woman for sex, what we see in these is, for those of you who are not familiar with this story, and I'll admit I'm addicted to this story because it's so convoluted and seedy and awful that it's hard to quite wrap your head around it. But we have the investigation of Mr. Gaetz going into an investigation with Mr. Greenberg, a gentleman who Joel Greenberg, who is a former tax collector in Seminole County, Florida, who was indicted last year on a federal sex trafficking charge and other crimes. And so he met the women through websites that connect people who go on dates in exchange for gifts, fine dining, travel, and allowances. And then Mr. Greenberg introduced the women to Mr. Gaetz, who apparently had sex with them, allegedly. Also, according to these receipts, bought them hotel rooms and ecstasy. Okay. Some of the men and women took ecstasy, an illegal mood-altering drug, before having sex, including Mr. Gates, according to the people familiar with the encounters. In some cases, Mr. Gates asked women to help find others who might be interested in having sex with him and his friends, according to two people familiar with those conversations. This all is separate, but adds on to the story that was broken yesterday about how Matt Gates is known of showing pictures of the women that he has, quote unquote, hooked up with on the floor of the U.S. Senate. Alan.
Yes, in the nude, by the way. Now, let me just say, we have Andrew Cuomo, who is under the gun for kissing people on the cheek or the hand or holding their face in his hand. And we have this now.
And many other things.
I'm sorry?
Well, Andrew Cuomo is under the gun, not just for kissing women's hands in their cheeks, but there are other serious allegations against Andrew Cuomo.
That's all true. However, Judith, as you probably know, these that I've just referenced have been in the paper virtually every day. Point I was trying to make is none of it is good. It isn't good for Andrew Cuomo, but this is Republican hypocrisy 101. It brings us right to the point where they're always willing to point the finger and to talk about morality and to talk about, you know, doing right. And then you find that this is something that is so severe. I mean, I remember when the big fear for Eliot Spitzer was bringing somebody across the state lines for the purpose of sex. Here we have it again. So what is Gates out on this? What is he expected to do? Will it be like Donald Trump? Oh, there's no big. I'm just going to stay with it. What do you think, Judith?
Well, Gates is denying everything and then going on Fox News and incriminating himself. I mean, I think he's clearly...
And various investigations, but go ahead.
Yeah, I think he's clearly in some kind of trouble. I think there's an important factual... piece of information we need to learn. Are these women or are these girls? Are they underage? There's enormous hypocrisy here, even if half of the charges are true. Before this was made public by the New York Times, Gates was talking about leaving Congress and working at Newsmax or some other station. Fox put out a statement yesterday saying no one has ever had conversations with Gates about him coming on to Fox as an employee. So he's obviously in big trouble. Everyone is presumed innocent until tried, but it certainly looks very suspicious. And I might add, very in character for Matt Gates. I mean, he really... You know, I didn't know his history until recently.
Me either.
You know, he has a very affluent father. He served in the Florida legislature.
His father was the president of the Florida Senate.
Yeah. And Gates did not distinguish himself when he was a state legislator. And he certainly hasn't as a Congress member. I thought McCarthy's initial comments, even with serious statements about Gates, that maybe he'd be stripped of serving on a committee was so politically tone deaf. I think the question right now is, does Gates land in jail? Forget about serving on congressional committees. I don't understand how these guys have time for all of this. I mean,
well,
we're all working, you know,
you can always make time, Judith.
Well, yeah.
You know, the other thing that's unfortunate about this whole story is that, you know, to Alan's point about the hypocrisy, you know, will we see Elise Stefanik, who has a website filled with merchandise that we can buy and impeaching Governor Cuomo, will she be adding, you know, the Matt Gates collection to her wardrobe line? I don't know, but I doubt it.
You know what's terrible to Judith's point about not knowing, you know, how they managed to find all the time here is that at no point in our recent history have we as a country have had so many challenges that have been foisted upon us, right, both internationally as well as domestically. And this is this is what we have representing all of us in our government. You know, we have the Marjorie Taylor Greens of the world. We have the Matt Gaetz of the world. These clowns are the clowns that are in positions where their you know, power can in fact help change the current trajectory of our nation. And here he is, you know, using cash apps to engage in crimes. And as we speak about Democrats and Republicans and the hypocrisy there, you know, the only distinction you could make is that Democrats like Spitzer, they wired money and used checks, and Republicans use cash apps. The bottom line is that they commit these crimes, and we need to demand better from our elected officials.
And we do not want to hear about family values from Republicans. We do not want to hear them criticizing marriage equality when they're largely silent when Gaetz and Trump, remember, many charges of sexual abuse against Trump. And so, you know, quiet on family values and stop attacking LGBTQ plus rights. No patience for that.
It's profound arrogance. Profound arrogance that you believe, you know, in a setting as serious as the halls of Congress or even on, you know, the House floor, that, you know, you've got photos and you're kind of giggling and showing them to your pals. Like, what arrogance to believe that everyone in that environment, you know, shares in your values. And there's not going to be a person in that group that thinks a little bit differently than you do and may not find that entertaining.
And the two people who are defending him at this point are Marjorie Taylor Greene, aforementioned, and Jim Jordan. Alan?
Well, you know, it gets stranger and stranger. I wanted to throw something back to Judith, if I may. You know, she, when I raised the Cuomo issue, she said, and much worse. I wondered if you would go into some of the, are you talking now about, what specifically are you looking at, Judith?
Well, I was just concerned, Alan, that it sounded like you were kind of understating the severity of the charges against Cuomo.
No, it's those charges. It's those charges I was interested in.
Yeah.
Because I had mentioned inappropriately holding somebody's hand or kissing their face or kissing their lips, all of which we don't like. No question about it.
Right, and there's more. There's the allegation that he groped a woman after inviting her over to the executive mansion, his home, to deal with a phone problem. And this woman alleges that he physically groped her in the mansion. Lindsay Boylan, the first woman, stating that she worked in a hostile work environment for a number of years and that the governor, unprompted, kissed her on the lips. The 25-year-old woman who was shared with the governor that she was a survivor of sexual assault and had him comment on that and so ask her questions on whether she's open to having sexual relations with older men. These are all, you know, violations of law if proven true. So I just wanted to make sure that the charges against the governor were not just kissing of a hand innocently and things like that.
Well, you make your point extremely well. However, I just want to say that my point is, when it happens in some Republican minds, like Stefanik's, to a Democrat, that's one thing. But when it happens to a Republican congressman who makes a lot of pro-Trumpian noises, that's a whole other. And I would say one does have to make choices here, and I go to David on this one, as to what's prosecutable and what's most serious.
Well, of course, that's my analysis. And every time you read the newspaper, you know, allegations that are written in a certain way, they all sound like, for example, sexual harassment. I think we all understand what sexual harassment is. Sexual harassment is not specifically defined in the penal law. There is actual physical harassment. And then, you know, there's other conduct relating to touching that are criminal offenses. And so we've got to do a much deeper dive in terms of the allegations to determine whether these are harassment that are morally, ethically, offensive, or do they rise to the level of assignment of criminal liability?
And you're the expert in criminal liability. What are you seeing?
There are a few that do rise to the level of criminal liability. Absolutely.
All right, I'm afraid we're going to have to stop there because we are out of time. And so my thanks to the whole group this morning. Alan Chartok, Judith Enk. Alan, thank you very much. Good to hear
you. Thank you. Thank
you, Joe. Thank you. Judith, Aaron, and David, thanks to everyone. If you are so inclined to celebrate, have a beautiful Easter. And we will talk to you all very soon. Thank you very much. We'll be right back with the Congressional Corner on WAMC.